Good morning to everybody on the line. I just want to let you know that we will get started in about 2 minutes.
You will now be placed into conference. This conference has been recorded.
Good morning, everybody. This is Suzanne Schaefer from the Brookings Institution. Thank you for joining our media call this morning. We're going to go ahead and get started. And just before we do, I want to mention that this call is on the record and is being recorded. I will send around a transcript about 24 hours afterward. And to those of you who have asked for the audio file, I will also provide that to you as well. Please be reminded throughout this call that when you are not speaking, it's incredibly important that you mute yourself. Otherwise, we'll get a lot of background noise that will interfere with the call, so please be sure to do that. And before we get started as well, I'd like everybody to please introduce themselves and say what outlet they're from. And then we will go straight to Tanvi Madan for her opening remarks, and then we'll go over to Bruce Riedel. So if anybody who is currently on the line could just say your name, that would be great.
Jill Colvin with the Associated Press.
Daniel Franklin at The Economist.
George Condon with the National Journal.
Howard LaFranchi, Christian Science Monitor.
Jordan Phelps, ABC News.
Eli Stokoe, LA Times.
Jerome Cartier with Agence France-Presse.
Peter Baker with the New York Times.
Akbar Advent with the Huffington Post.
Dave Lawler from ACU.
Okay, great. Welcome, everybody. Tanvi, if you want to get started.
Sure. Good morning to you all. So I just thought I'd kind of set the context for this visit and just highlight some of the things we might see from it and some of the things we will not see during the visit. The visit by American presidents that took place was President Obama's visit in 2015, and that was a very significant visit for various reasons, but particularly to do with Indian and U.S. Convergence on the subject of China and convergence in the Asia-Pacific as a whole. This visit is taking place in the context of a relationship for the Trump administration that has actually exhibited more continuity rather than change compared to a lot of other relationships that the U.S. has. The relationship has largely kind of escaped some of the kind of depths or some extent heights that we've seen, particularly in U.S. relations with some allies. And one of the reasons for this is something you will see reflected in over the next few days, or at least when President Trump is in India. I think what you will see during this visit is both the strategic convergences, which are the reason this visit is happening at all. You'll also see some of the divergences in the relationship, particularly on the subject of trade, where there are some frictions, though not quite a trade war between the two countries, more like a trade skirmish. And I think you also see, though, during this visit, some ways that the Indian government has, over the last few years, had to adjust to the very different kind of president that President Trump is. So just very quickly, in terms of convergences, the major area of convergence between the U.S. and India over the last few years has been on the diplomatic and security front. And it's been quite remarkable how much progress they have made, spurred in no small part by shared U.S. and Indian concerns about China's actions in the region, which they are increasingly calling the Indo-Pacific. Both countries have a free and open Indo-Pacific vision, though they're not exactly the same. There's a lot of overlap there, and I think you will see that reflected. So while you might not hear the word China mentioned, you will hear allusions to it constantly throughout remarks. And in some of the deals you'll see, I think you will see some defense deals around the visit and perhaps put into some of the joint statements. And President Trump will no doubt claim credit for them. These include kind of India buying helicopters for its Navy and perhaps adding to some attack helicopters and surveillance aircraft it has bought in the past. This will take a U.S.-India defense trade to over the $20 billion limit. Just to give you a sense of how far the U.S. and India have come on this, about a dozen years ago, that number was zero. You also potentially see, I would look for whether they actually sign the final one of what is called the foundational agreements. These are agreements that India used to resist sharing with the U.S. for sovereignty reasons, but we've seen a range of them signed over the last few years for defense and intelligence cooperation. And the final one is called BECA, the Basic Exchange and Cooperation Agreement. They've been negotiating it recently. They restarted negotiations, and we potentially could see some progress on that front. You'll see, I suspect, a laundry list in the joint statement, which will make kind of the breadth of the relationship apparent. There will be some details in there that might not be kind of big strategic issues, but really do show some of kind of what has made this relationship sustainable across many kind of different agencies, but also highlighting business collaboration as well as the diaspora connect that the two countries have. The big missing deliverable, at least for now, seems likely to be the one both countries had sought, which the trade deal. And this has eluded both sides because of their negotiating styles, lack of political will to a certain extent, different priorities. Both sides feel the others have changed goalposts, and their domestic political sensitivities in India to some of the concessions that the Trump administration wants. Could they still pull a rabbit out of the hat? Possibly. If the two leaders decide that it is a priority to at least get a trade ceasefire that can prevent some of these trade divergences from bleeding over into the strategic areas of convergence. I think partly because they have not been able to get to a trade deal, Prime Minister Modi will make an extra effort in delivering something else for President Trump, which is great optics. They will be sensitive on the Indian side that this is an election year in the U.S. They ideally do not like a presidential visit in an election year, but I think it is more important for them to have the U.S. president visit because it's a crucial relationship for India. And they will want to ensure that President Trump, who they see as transactional, will not feel that he leaves India empty-handed, even if he does end up getting, you know, stopping over, making an unannounced stopover on the way to sign a deal with the Taliban and get that deal. I think Delhi will want him, so they will give him the defense deals. But I think they'll also, in terms of deliver the kind of large audience that he craves in the stadium event that he's doing, and some visuals that his election campaign will use, but I think the Indian government will be more sensitive, given their experience with Harry Modi, of this not being seen by Democrats as an endorsement. Finally, kind of, you know, you'll see various instances that will tell you how differently India has dealt with President Trump as opposed to previous presidents. This kind of stadium event is happening. In recent years, these kind of events haven't happened. Presidents have spoken to smaller groups. But the Indian government has been kind of largely sensitive to having American presidents speak to large domestic audiences. This is not unprecedented. President Eisenhower, when he went to 1959, spoke to a crowd of 500,000. But it is unusual in recent years. And so I think the fact that the Indian government doing this is quite different from previous times. Second thing, defense deals, they're usually not announced. India doesn't like to announce defense deals during these leader-level summits with the U.S. And so, again, the fact that it's doing it is because it's President Trump who they see as kind of, this is tailor-made for him in terms of announcing deals. They're also kind of reportedly were willing to make procurement commitments in trade talks, also very unusual for them. And they will also, I think, finally downplay any statements that he makes, off-the-cuff statements that he makes on, you know, offering mediation on Kashmir, or if he makes, statements on Pakistan or China, 5G, that they would normally take exception to. And so I think you see them kind of try to roll out the red carpet and ensure that he leaves with a good feeling about India. It's not about him per se for them. It is the U.S. relationship for India is crucial as they look at not just the China challenge that's looming, but also an economic growth slowdown in a context that they still look for the U.S. as an economic partnership over the next few years.
Okay, thank you, Tanvi. Bruce, if you want to get started.
Yes, certainly. I want to pick up with one point that Tanvi just made about continuity. I think this trip really is about continuity. 20 years ago, Bill Clinton made his visit to India just about the same time of year. And since then, I think there's been a very strong bipartisan consensus in Washington that India truly is a strategic partner. It's an important country in the global environment. It's a country the United States needs to get much closer to. We've now seen President Trump will be the fourth president in a row to go to India to celebrate that relationship. And that's a big change. As Tanvi's very excellent new book points out, the United States does not always think of India as a strategic partner or even a player on the world stage that was worth courting. For much of the first 50 years of India's independence, the United States had a very ambivalent relationship with India, one troubled by its relationships with Pakistan in particular. That really changed in 2000, and that continuity, that consensus is there today. As Tanvi has laid out, it's been turned into material because institutions on both sides, particularly the military and security services on both sides, have come to really value this relationship. India has more military exercises with the United States than many of our NATO allies have with the United States, which is really extraordinary considering we had virtually no military relationship with India just a quarter of a century ago. I think there is one other thing to point out about the continuity argument here. While India still is held in high regard in the United States by both sides of the aisle, I think there are more questions in the last 6 months about India's commitment to democracy, to tolerance, and concerns about Islamophobia in India than we've really seen in the history of the U.S.-Indian relationship. These concerns are not a threat to the survival of the relationship, but a question mark over that relationship. The good news for India is that the last person in the world likely to raise any of these issues is Donald Trump. He's an Islamophobe himself. He doesn't practice tolerance for dissidents at home. So these issues are not going to come up in this visit, but they're underneath the surface, and they are going to become a problem in the relationship as time goes on, and probably more of a problem if the Democrat is elected in November. Let me turn from the bilateral relationship to two of the elephants, not in the room, but just outside of it, that will hang over this trip. One, Tanvi already alluded to, which is the question of Afghanistan. The Trump administration very badly wants to get a deal with the Taliban signed and moving in the next few weeks. Much of the groundwork for that has already been accomplished, both by our negotiator in Doha, Zal Khalilzad, and I would say even more importantly, by Secretary of State Pompeo, working with the Pakistanis. If a deal is ready to be signed, I can't imagine that Donald Trump is going to not want to be there. He's going to want to be in that picture. It was, after all, his idea to sign it in September at Camp David, which I just have to say parenthetically, in 45 years working in government or about government, I have never heard of a worse idea than signing a deal at Camp David with the Taliban. This won't be at Camp David. I don't know exactly how they'll pull it off, but I think Trump very much would want to be in that picture. Such a deal is very problematic. We can talk about it more in Q&A. It is going to be very difficult to accomplish, but I think for the president it would be a significant accomplishment and check the box of him doing something about the endless wars. The other elephant in the room or outside the room, I think is less likely to get a presidential stopover, but I wouldn't rule it out completely, and that's Pakistan. If you really want to move the deal on Afghanistan with the Taliban forward, you need to get the Pakistanis firmly in the loop. The president has developed a surprisingly good relationship with Imran Khan. I don't think anyone would have anticipated that 2 years ago, but it seems to be a good relationship. And as I said, Secretary Pompeo has a very good relationship with Imran Khan and also with his Pakistani counterpart. It is possible that you could see a sudden decision to add Pakistan for a quick trip. Most presidents, when they do go to South Asia, include Pakistan on the itinerary. Eisenhower, who was the first president to go to South Asia, did the trifecta of India, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. We'll see how Donald Trump fares on this trip. My State Department colleagues tell me that there is no plans in the States right now for a Pakistan stop. When I ask them about Afghanistan, they all go mute. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Bruce. And Tom, if you'd like to add a comment?
Yes, I just want to echo Bruce's point that one thing you will not see is explicit criticism of Indian domestic policy and politics, whether it's its actions vis-a-vis Kashmir or with the Citizenship Amendment Act that's been passed. I think you might see, and I would listen closely in the speech that he gives in the stadium to allusions about the strength of India being a diverse, pluralistic, and stable country. This is something President Obama did as well when he made a speech to students and kind of young people in general. And it was very much seen as a message that is what partly makes India attractive for the U.S. as a whole in key constituencies, and that any regression in that could have an impact on U.S. Support for India.
Okay, thank you. All right, we're going to open it up to you guys on the phone. But just before we do, please, again, remember to keep yourself muted when you're not speaking. And before you do ask a question, please introduce yourself. But with that, take it away.
Hi, this is Jordan Phelps with ABC. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So first question is on the issue of Kashmir. Can you give us a little bit more context around the Indian perspective on the president's offer to be a mediator in this? My understanding is that Pakistan has expressed some willingness, but India has really shut it down. And then I was hoping, you've already touched on this, but we're talking about the great optics of this trip. This trip, in a lot of ways, to me, seems like it's mostly about those great optics and putting this relationship on display. So could you expand a little bit just on that element of the trip, please?
Sure, I'll jump in, and then maybe Bruce can respond as well. On Kashmir, the responses of India and Pakistan are fairly kind of consistent with their historical approach. Pakistan has welcomed the internationalization of the Kashmir issue because it sees that as kind of giving it more leverage in negotiations with India. But largely over the last few years, American presidents used to make it a habit of offering mediation, even if not themselves. They've stopped doing it partly because American administrations, and Bruce can talk a little bit more about this, having had direct experience, have come to the conclusion that while it would be really helpful for India and Pakistan to kind of reach an agreement to the Kashmir dispute, that India will not accept international mediation, and so that they treat it as largely a bilateral dispute with, of course, a kind of very high stakes if it breaks out into conflict. And so the Indians have seen kind of I think when the President Trump first made the offers, and they were aware that in the past, even before he was president, he's talked about, just like he had on kind of, you know, other peace deals, he's talked about making, trying to make peace between India and Pakistan. But I think they largely kind of, they would have objected vociferously if anybody else had made the comments and pushed back much more strongly. But now they just reiterate their traditional position that this is a bilateral dispute which will be settled and talked about between India and Pakistan. They also usually point to his caveat, which President Trump has been kind of stuck to his talking points and added, that he will only mediate if both sides are willing. And, of course, the Indians just say they are not willing. On the optics, Bruce Hoyle kind of attests to this as well. All American presidential visits to India are optic heavy. In some ways, American presidents go to India to feel loved. They get, you know, a huge amount of welcomes, despite, you know, even President Bush, who was not considered to be very, you know, popular around the world. When he went to India towards the end of his administration, where he was getting criticized in U.S. Allies and in other places, his popularity rating was very high. His favorability ratings were very high in India. And Prime Minister Manmohan Singh then kind of hugged him and told him that, you know, all of India loves you. And, you know, whether it's President Clinton, President Obama, Indians really do roll out the red carpet for American presidents. They are often invited to speak to joint sessions of parliament. You know, there's a lot of color. This is a loud and boisterous country. And that's exactly kind of, in some ways, very fits with the Trump kind of style. He has been there before. He was there in 2014 when Prime Minister Modi had just come to office. But, of course, he was then a businessman, not a president. So he's not unfamiliar with the country and, of course, has his family has business there. But I think the optics, he will get more of them than other presidents do, because I think the Indians recognize that is something that he will want and will appreciate and will perhaps, you know, keep them in good stead over the next few months, even as some of those trade frictions rear their ugly head every once in a while. So I think you'll see, you know, the stadium visit. There will not be 7 million people on the streets, but I think there will be a lot of people. And as long as it looks like a lot of people to President Trump, I think the Indians will be satisfied. So I think you'll see, you know, state dinner at the presidential palace, which for those of you who have been to Delhi is quite impressive as a building, the former viceroy's residence. And you'll see, I would not be shocked if the Indians named something after President Trump. This would also not be unusual. There's a village, actually just 15 minutes drive from the Trump Tower near Delhi. It's a village called Kartapuri, which is named after Jimmy Carter when he was there. So I think you will see them make extra efforts on this optics front for this president.
Let me just add a couple of brief points on Kashmir. The Indians have, from the beginning of the Kashmir dispute, said this is a bilateral matter. I think that's even more intense now that Modi has changed the constitutional arrangements for Kashmir to make it more integrated into the Indian state than ever before. The administration has no plan, no practical plan for mediating between India and Pakistan on Kashmir. In 1999, President Clinton briefly flirted with the idea of mediation and the Indians shut it down almost immediately. I think the Pakistanis were to some extent shocked when the president offered to mediate during his meeting with Imran Khan. If you look closely at the face of the prime minister when that offer came up, it was almost like he was puzzled. They would love to pursue it. They will certainly bring it up. I don't think they're going to find much of a resonance with the Trump administration. And Tanvi's absolutely right about optics. I traveled with President Clinton in 2000 to India, and the nearest thing I can say to it was must have been like what it was when the Beatles came to America for the first time. It was just crazy. Enormous crowds everywhere he went. And this for the man who had just imposed the most intense economic sanctions on India in the history of the bilateral relationship, which were still in place during that visit, the outpouring was enormous.
Okay, thank you, Bruce. More questions?
This is Howard LaFranchi, Christian Science Monitor. Just a quick question for Bruce, but is there any potential downside for the president in being in the picture, as you say, signing the deal with the Taliban, given, up until just, last week or recently, still killing U.S. soldiers. So I'm just wondering if you see, is there any, politically, is it all good for the president or is there some downside?
I think it's risky. I think it's very risky. Just based on watching Trump's behavior over the last 5 years, it seems to me it's the kind of risk that he relishes taking. But you're absolutely right. You could have the day after the signing a car bomb go off in Kabul and 30, 40 people killed. They didn't have to be Americans, but it would be even worse if some of them were Americans, which would immediately demonstrate that this deal is at best off to a shaky start, if not stillborn. But the other risk is more long-term. Under the best of circumstances, getting a deal between the Afghans, which is, after all, what we really need in order to have a stable departure, is very, very hard to do. And it's gotten even harder in the last couple of days with the announcement of the alleged results of the Afghan presidential election, which have been rejected by Abdullah Abdullah. And we now, in effect, have two Afghan governments. Who's going to negotiate with which government? It's a big complication to an already very complicated problem. I think the risk here for Donald Trump is less serious simply because it's not going to have the same kind of visuals and optics that a massive car bomb going off in Kabul or something like that happening would have. But it would certainly tend to undermine the impact of any deal come November, which I think is very, very important. I know it's very, very important for the Trump administration.
Thank you.
Hey, Steve Bruce, and just a reminder to please mute yourself. We do have some typing noise coming through. But next question.
This is Akbar Ahmed with HuffPost. Thanks for the call. Could you comment on the private sector's sort of view of this, particularly the U.S. business community? I mean, given that you said it's unlikely to kind of get a comprehensive trade deal, sort of what can President Trump come back to Wall Street or others interested in the Indian market and say he's achieved from this? Or what are the expectations?
I'm sure, there is a kind of a CEO summit that will take place on the sidelines of the visit. And one of the things you'll see there is that American companies are actually a little bit wary of the approach that the president has taken in terms of, because they think there's too much emphasis on tariffs, tariff reductions and things like that. What American companies would like to see more of, and it was unlikely that we were going to see in kind of a trade package, a mini trade deal that they were negotiating, is a better investment climate and more market access in India, and the Indian kind of government addressing restrictions in two areas. One, like the Europeans, India is kind of going through a process of detailing and laying out some rules about data localization. They want Indians' data being stored in India. This has caused some complications for a number of Indian companies that operate there and don't want to actually do this. But second, there are now companies, for there are kind of some e-commerce restrictions that India has put in place, particularly for companies like Amazon and Walmart, this matters. Having said that, they don't want the U.S. and India to kind of get into any sort of kind of heightened trade tensions, because they actually think that even though India is not the easiest place to do business, it's still a good place for them to be, particularly for the companies that have been shut out of China. So I think they'll want to see the administration do what they can to open up the Indian market. But this is where kind of Prime Minister Modi and President Trump, for all their kind of the comparisons made about their similarity, are quite different in economic philosophy. Prime Minister Modi's party can be quite protectionist in various ways. Even government can be quite protectionist. And he doesn't, in terms of kind of keeping the market restricted and closed. So unless we see kind of a really rethink in the Indian government that they need to open up the economy as they did in the early 90s with serious economic reforms liberalizing the economy, you're not going to see that necessarily get any better for American companies. I think they're going to kind of keep trying to get some concessions along the way, try to kind of ensure that bad policy doesn't get implemented, and work directly with the Indian government to get some of these restrictions lifted or not put in place in the first place. I think you will see also some highlighting while this trip happens of Indian companies that are investing in the U.S. and creating jobs, partly to create, kind of send a signal that, you know, President Trump is bringing these companies' investments kind of predate President Trump, but I think he'll want to say that, you know, he's bringing some of this investment in. And it suits India's purposes to say, look, our companies are not taking jobs, they're creating jobs, to mitigate some of the concerns about immigration and kind of high-skilled worker concerns that the Trump administration has.
Okay, thank you. Next question. Are there any additional questions?
Hi there. This is Dave Lawler from Axios. Just a question about the domestic political situation that Trump is walking into in India. I'm just wondering whether, you know, perhaps he won't refer directly to the citizenship law or to protests, et cetera, but wondering how closely, you know, his remarks will be watched on any of those things, any references, obviously. After Kashmir, he made a remark on protecting borders that got a lot of attention. Just kind of wondering whether, you know, Trump riffing on this stuff has major domestic political implications in India. Thanks.
I think it won't have major domestic implications, but it will be watched very carefully. I think if he does say something, and I suspect his prepared remarks will have these allusions, you know, support for kind of calling diversity, pluralism, India's strengths. I think you'll see it in that way in his kind of talking points and in his, at least in his public talking points and in his speech. I think you might see it brought up somewhat privately. And I think there are concerns within the administration, though not, as Bruce said, on the part of President Trump about some of these moves. For different reasons. Some care about it as people some members of Congress in the Hill do for the impact on democracy and human rights. But there are others who are concerned about what this does to Indian stability and whether these are distractions from what India should be focusing on, which is its economy and its kind of military strengthening in the face of a rising China. And they'll see, you know, they have concerns that Prime Minister Modi is using the political capital he has for these moves, which won't really add to kind of India playing this regional role that the U.S. would like it to. So I think you will hear some concern, but I don't think this is going to be front and center for the administration to bring up too much. But I think they will want to send a message that they aren't kind of looking the other way. You've seen also in the last few days chair of a key subcommittee go to the Democratic chair of a key House subcommittee, travel to India with the ranking member and express concerns about Kashmir. This is Congressman Army Bearer about Kashmir, but the Citizenship Amendment Act as well. There's always the possibility that President Trump, you know, sees something on TV while he's there. And if you get a chance, you know, put your earphones on, but if you watch Indian TV channels, you'll notice they're quite vocal and vociferous. If he sees something, you know, while going through Indian TV channels about protests, it is a democratic country, there are protests going on, you know, they're even kind of people who disapprove of the Trump visit. So, you know, if he sees kind of something about Kashmir or the Citizenship Amendment Act protests, he could make an off-the-cuff remark. It won't go down well with the government. A number of members of the Indian press will pick up on it. Will it have domestic political implications? No. But arguably, it has already had domestic political implications, at least the act itself, in terms of some setbacks politically that Prime Minister Modi has had in state-level elections, both these protests as well as kind of the stalling of the Indian economic growth rate.
If I could add just one point, as we all have come to realize, Donald Trump's capacity for off-the-cuff remarks that at best are amusing and sometimes are worse than that is legendary. Apparently, he alluded in a previous meeting with Prime Minister Modi to the notion that India does not share a border with China, when, of course, India shares one of the longest borders in the world with China. I think the propensity, as Tanvi has suggested, of the Indian government will be to laugh these things off or to just try to, you know, throw them away as meaningless. The Indian press, on the other hand, will pounce on something like that and have a field day with it. And that could start a spiral of comments. We'll see. It's certainly something I'm sure that the president's advisors are going to try to avoid happening, but it's Donald Trump's show, and as we know, it can be quite entertaining sometimes.
Okay, thank you, Bruce. Are there any additional questions?
Hi, this is Bhavan.
Yes. All right. Are there any additional questions? All right. If there are no further questions, we'll go ahead and end the call. But I do just want to flag for you all really quickly. As mentioned in the invitation email, Tanvi Madan does have a new book recently published called Fateful Triangle, How China Shaped U.S.-India Relations During the Cold War. It is, of course, quite relevant to this conversation, and I encourage you all to check that out. Again, I'll send around a transcript shortly after, not to exceed 24 hours, but do send me an email if you have any follow-up questions or comments. All right, thank you. Thank you, Tanvi, and thank you, Bruce, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please stand by.